Garpax's most notable trades from 2014 to the present can best be described as a play in two acts. Act 1 was rocky at best, and that's even excluding the acquisition of Doug McDermott in the 2014 draft. The front office stood pat for the better part of 2 years, opting not to acquire all-star players like Kevin Love or Josh Smith. They didn't make their first notable trade in this period until the summer of 2016, when they sent former MVP Derrick Rose to the New York Knicks for a package including Robin Lopez and Jerian Grant. After clearing cap space to sign veterans Rajon Rondo and Dwayne Wade, the Bulls opted to add more guard depth prior to the season, trading 2013 draft choice Tony Snell to the Milwaukee Bucks for Michael Carter-Williams. Carter-Williams, who was a former Rookie of the Year, struggled mightily with the Bulls, while Snell proved to be a valuable role player, shooting a career-high 40% from the three-point line that season. Their bad luck in the trade market continued into the year. In February 2017, Garpax dealt Taj Gibson, Doug McDermott, and a 2018 second-round pick to the Oklahoma City Thunder for Joffrey Laverne, Anthony Morrow, and Cameron Payne. While trading both Gibson and McDermott made sense at the time, the returning package was a bitter pill to swallow. Laverne and Morrow were barely contributors in their lone season with the team, and Payne, who the front office painted as the centerpiece of the trade, was a complete flop. In almost 3 seasons with the Bulls, he never found his footing as a starter or even a valuable role player. Now when you get to Act 2 of Garpax's trades during this period, it's a much rosier picture. On draft night 2017, the Bulls traded Jimmy Butler and the draft rights to Justin Patton to the Minnesota Timberwolves for Zach LaVine, Chris Dunn, and the rights to Lauri Markkanen. LaVine and Markkanen have proven to be valuable young pieces to the franchise, and both of them certainly have plenty of room to grow. Despite being somewhat erratic, even Dunn has shown value as a solid role player. On the other hand, Butler has continued to have an all-star caliber career, but his drama and abrasive personality have been somewhat detrimental. Butler is now on his third team in 2 years. He joined the Miami Heat this summer on a max deal, after burning bridges with both the Timberwolves and Philadelphia 76ers. In 2018, the front office pulled off another solid trade. They parted with former 2011 draft choice Nikola Mirotic, dealing him to the New Orleans Hornets for a package that included a lottery-protected first-round pick. The pick morphed into the number 22 selection, which the Bulls used on Chandler Hutchison. Yes, the Bulls had to take on Omer Asik's beefy contract, and the jury is still out on Hutch's career, but getting first-round draft capital was still impressive. And seeing as Mirotic voluntarily left the NBA for Europe this summer, it's probably good that the team cut their losses early. Last season, the front office made 2 shrewd trades. The first one came in January, when they dealt Justin Holiday to the Memphis Grizzlies for a package that included Wayne Selden and both a 2019 and 2020 second-round pick. The 2019 pick yielded them athletic Arkansas center Daniel Gafford this past June. It was clear Holiday no longer had a viable role with the team, and netting 2 second-rounders and a young role player for him was likely the best possible deal. Their other savvy move came a month later near the deadline. After giving Jabari Parker a prove-it deal in the summer of 2018, it was clear Parker wasn't a long-term fit as the season went on, so Garpax acted swiftly. Parker was traded with Bobby Portis to the Washington Wizards for Otto Porter Jr. Both Parker and Portis were not going to be with the team beyond 2019, and even though Porter came with a hefty contract, he definitely showed that he complements the young core better as a 3-and-D wing. It's fair to say that Garpax definitely got better in the trade market since 2017. Sure, there have been some odd deals for cash considerations, but there also have been solid moves to help set the foundation for the team's young core. Okay, so the Jimmy Butler trade is a good place to start for our discussion. I feel like this is really one of the first trades where Garpax sold a player at his highest possible value. Let me ask Matt first. As of August 2019, right now, did the Bulls win the Jimmy Butler trade?
Yes, no question. It's partly about getting rid of the problem that Jimmy Butler was becoming while knowing that the player that problem was attached to was never going to be a good enough player to be your number one guy on a championship team. And they figured out that they could not, and part of it is the fault of their own, but they could not build a winner around him. You think about the contract that he was due, the designated player exception contract that Jimmy would have been up for staying with the team that drafted him, and you're talking about paying Jimmy Butler some of these gross numbers that we see players like Chris Paul and Russell Westbrook getting on these contracts, and you're talking about paying a Jimmy Butler with a lot of miles on his legs, you know, somewhere around the neighborhood between $35 and $40 million a year in the back end of his prime, I was always terrified of the concept of doing that. And when you think about the return, clearly, you know, we were just talking in part one about how it looks like Chris Dunn is on the outs. But even if that trade still netted you Zach LaVine and Lauri Markkanen, the two pieces that the fan base is really trying to get excited about right now, the two pieces that show you that they are young and have real all-star and in some might say all NBA potential, yes, the Bulls won that trade.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt right now. I mean, the biggest question is, would Jimmy Butler, can he be the best player in a team to winning a title? And I don't see how you can possibly argue that he could be, you know, and he's a walking contradiction, you know, so he goes to Minnesota and just basically blows up that situation. And regardless of how you feel about Towns and Wiggins, they are two of the most talented, especially Towns to me is the arguably one of the most talented players in the NBA under 25 years old. He's a fantastic player. And what does he do? He questions their work ethic. He questioned Rose's work ethic. He's clearly a guy you got to admire in one sense that he's made himself into a great player and he's worked very hard to do so. But as far as leadership qualities, you know, there's a lot to be desired there. I think the worst thing you can do as not just a leader, as a human, is to question one of the worst things you can do is question the work ethic of a coworker. Publicly, it's the worst. It's there's never any situation where that's a good move. You can question him directly behind closed doors, and he's done it continually. He did it, you know, for Rose. He did it in Minnesota. He didn't do it in Philadelphia because he's in the contract here. But I mean, if you believe what he says, and I'm all about winning, and that's all I care about, then why is he not in Philadelphia? He's playing for. How could anyone argue that the situation in Miami is going to end up much better than it's going to be in Philadelphia for the next 4 years? It's insanity. So, you know, Jimmy Butler clearly wasn't all about winning. He wasn't all about that's the biggest focus. He's more about I want to be the guy, and that's the kind of guy you should trade. And they got Lauri Markkanen, who I think we both agree has tremendous potential, and Zach LaVine, who is took a massive jump next year. I expect him to be the Bulls' first All-Star this year in a number of years. And then Chris Dunn, who I still believe in, it's a massive win.
Earlier in part one, I asked about Lauri's ceiling and his floor. I'm curious, and I'll start with you, Fred. What do you think Zach LaVine's ceiling can be, and where do you think his floor is?
There's been few players in the last 20 years in the Bulls organization that have been better set up for success than Zach LaVine has this year. He's got four shooters around him, if Sandoransky starts, that are all plus shooters for their position. And if Wendell Carter Jr. improves, as I expect him to do so, it's going to be, you know, basketball is a very simple, it's developed into a very simple game. I think we kind of make it more complicated than it really should be. It's about spreading the floor with good shooting and having players who can punish a spread out defense. And Zach LaVine last year proved he's close to one of the better players in the NBA at punishing, attacking the rim, a spread out defense. The problem with the Bulls last year is they didn't have nearly enough shooting until Otto Porter arrived to really spread the defense. So he had Zach attacking and just not enough room to operate, not enough room to work. I always use this analogy that when you have Kyle Korver used to make the court look like a football field for Derrick Rose and that he would spread it out. And Derrick Rose, if you put a basket on the goal line and you started him out the 50-yard line, there's not a player in the NBA that could have stopped him from getting to the rim. But if you went on a bowling lane, there's not a player in the league who couldn't stop Rose from getting to the, you know, and put a basket at where the pins are. So that's what players' good shooting does. It makes it look like a football field as opposed to a bowling lane. And so Zach is set up for a great season. I expect him to have a fantastic year and make the All-Star team. So my ceiling for LaVine is like top 20. I think he'll end up somewhere between 15 and 20 at his best. He's kind of an interesting player that his defense, he's got all the physical characteristics to be a good defensive player, and he's just so awful at that side of the ball. And now would expect to see some improvement there. But I did see improvement in the offensive side where I thought he really facilitated well in February. You saw his assist numbers around 7. When he wants to on the offensive end, he's got very few weaknesses. He could shoot, he could pass, attack the rim. I love the kid, and he really got to the line a lot too last year. So I'm very bullish on Zach LaVine.
Yeah, I mean, again, I would agree with Fred. Simply, I think he's got top 20 potential. I liked the times last season when we saw him really flourish distributing the ball and getting those assist numbers up. We also saw him struggle with that at times when he was the primary ball handler. And, you know, we saw some of those like double digit turnover games from LaVine, and you hope those disappear as he gets more experience with being that real, you know, offensive leader on the court most nights. Defensively, again, I'm with Fred, but disappointed. We keep hearing these quotes and these amazing, terrific sound bites from LaVine about improving his game on the defensive end this offseason. We know he's been putting crazy work in this offseason. Will we see it? I hope so, but I don't know. His floor is a guy who can beat a lot of guys in the league one-on-one and get buckets, but doesn't do much more than that. And that's kind of what Bulls fans feared he was in his, you know, injury shortened first season, coming off the ACL in 17-18. We saw him do so much more in the 18-19 season that I think that most Bulls fans are starting to believe that the ceiling is more likely than the floor. And I would be, you know, a part of that group.
All right. So guys, I got more of those fun rapid fire questions. You ready?
Let's do it.
Absolutely.
All right. So first one, and we'll start with you, Matt. Worst trade from this period: Tony Snell for Michael Carter Williams, or Taj Gibson and Doug McDermott for Laverne Morrow and Cameron Payne?
Let us not forget Taj Gibson, Doug McDermott, and a pick.
Yes.
And a pick for Laverne Morrow and Payne. Look, clearly that's the answer. I mean, getting Michael Carter Williams for Snell at the time, you know, it, again, one of those hindsight things. It was terrible. Michael Carter Williams was nothing but the butt of a joke. He was a punchline here in Chicago. His 4-on-1 fast break that failed, shooting corner threes that hit the side of the backboard. He was a joke. At the time of that trade, however, Tony Snell was a gigantic disappointment in Chicago. And most Bulls fans were saying, wow, I can't believe we actually got a player for Tony Snell in a trade. At the time, it was seen as a, you know, player who needs a fresh start. For a player who needs a fresh start, maybe there's still some kind of lingering potential between those two players in Snell and Carter Williams. Did anyone feel anything positive about giving up Doug and Taj, even knowing that Taj was on an expiring deal and that he was likely not going to be paid to stick around based on the way things were going? Even knowing that, did anyone feel good about giving up Doug, who, you know, again, the trade of 2014 and everything that went into that, and Taj, and a pick to get essentially campaign because LaVerne and Morrow were also expiring deals? No.
I really wanted LaVerne.
You did?
No, I'm just kidding. I'm fucking
He flashed a lot of potential when he got those minutes in a Bulls jersey.
Clearly, the trade for McDermott, the McDermott and Taj trade to Oklahoma City was the worst trade. I will counter that. I think before that season, I have no proof of this besides some, you know, just casual conversations where it was kind of alluded to. But I think Paxson internally was like the one member of the organization who probably wanted to do a full rebuild in 2016. And he was kind of, I bet, outvoted by Gar and Reinsdorf to go after, Wade, go after Rondo and give it a run around Jimmy. And so what happened was obviously it turned into a disaster at that point. And they decided to, I think that was like the first step in the Bulls attempting to get into the lottery. I think they wanted to get rid of, you know, Taj was obviously an expiring deal. He was not going to be re-signed. And then get rid of McDermott off the roster and his contract. And bring in a kid, campaign, who they liked. It was obviously a lottery pick by Oklahoma City. But he had injury problems and he never made it here, you know. So I think that effort was to actually kind of jumpstart the rebuild and get into the lottery. But what happened was Nico finally woke up. Nico, the untold story that year, was absolutely atrocious for a team that needed outside shooting. They were very dependent on Nico Mirotic and Doug McDermott, and Nico failed miserably. He was shooting around 29% up until that point, that trade, which is just an unmitigated disaster, and with over 200 attempts. And then he suddenly got hot like he always does in March, and they made a playoff run. So, yeah, but without a doubt, I mean, Michael Carter Williams or Tony Snell. Tony Snell, in retrospect, was probably a good move because Milwaukee ended up signing him for, you know, pretty awful contract where they had to actually give up assets just to get him off the roster.
You know, actually, to build off that, you brought up Nico, so I want to go to this next question of a better trade. The Nikola Mirotic trade for a protected first rounder or dealing Jabari Parker and Bobby Portis for Otto Porter? And I'll start with you, Fred.
Well, it's hard to say considering, you know, the book is still out on Hutch. I was shocked they were able to get a first rounder for Nico. I thought Nico was guy. His playoff numbers are a complete disaster. He's basically great. He's a bum slayer when the pressure's not on. When it matters most, he's nowhere to be found. I'm so glad I don't have to deal with that guy anymore. What was the question again? What was the other part?
So
I just got so mad about Nico.
No, which was a better trade, Nico for the protected first or Parker and Portis for Porter?
Otto Porter Jr., without a doubt. Bringing him in and just seeing the general reaction of anger from everyone about that deal, it was, in retrospect, so utterly ridiculous considering, you know, Otto Porter Jr., let's just pretend he was a unrestricted free agent this past season. Let's pretend he was out on the market. What do you think he would have been signed for? Somewhere probably between $20 and $25 million. So he's making what, 26, 27? He's overpaid by a few million. I think the fact that Wendell Carter and Laurie make a combined $10.5 million helps to, you know, mitigate the fact that we're not that we're overpaying slightly for Otto Porter Jr. He's exactly what the team needed. They played 500 when he arrived, basically, because he actually helped spread the floor, shot an incredible rate from three. He's a total pro. I think a kind of untalked about stories, unfortunately, he is going to probably opt out at the end of this upcoming season and leave the Bulls with a very difficult situation and difficult choice to make on whether or not to resign him for a long-term big money deal or to let him walk and then go for the Giannis sweepstakes in 2021. It's going to be a very tough decision coming forward because I do predict that he will walk. He will exercise his option to become an unrestricted free agent.
Interesting. You think he's going to turn down $28.5 guaranteed million dollars?
Well, let's say he has a great season, Matt, and replicates what he did last year. Let's say he does that. What do you think he would get in the open market this upcoming season, considering how poor this free agent market is?
Well, I was going to say, not quite that, but he would probably have the opportunity to get overpaid again because the 2020 free agent class is not great. So I see your point there. My answer to the question of, you know, what's the better trade is, while I do, it's one of the few things Fred and I agree on, I was never an Nico fan. God, oh my God. I was on Bobby's side when Bobby punched Nico in the face. All right. Like, I took Bobby's side in that whole ordeal. And guess what? So did the press and so did the Bulls organization. It was like Donald saying, you know, oh, they're good, like, good, fine people on both sides. They were defending Bobby. So clearly something was up with Nico and he was not everybody's favorite person. Even that being said, and the fact that I was also surprised the Bulls were able to net a first-round pick for Nico, and I agree with Fred, you know, the stats are still out on Hutch. Who knows what that guy's going to turn into? We know what Otto Porter is, and we saw in February when the Bulls actually looked like an NBA team compared to the rest of that god-awful season we just endured, that there was no coincidence between that team playing respectable basketball and Otto Porter Jr. arriving. He did so many things to help that team. He filled so many roles and positions of need that the Bulls just were crying out for. And again, I said it before, he is going to be the most important person to stay healthy on this roster this season. That trade, getting him for a Jabari failure and an expiring Bobby who you were lucky to not pay $50 million to last summer, absolutely. That's a home run of a trade.
So I actually want to ask you guys about a trade that didn't happen. So I want to go back to the summer of 2014. We talked about Carmelo in part one and Pau Gasol, but there was a report at the time that the Bulls were interested in jumping into the Kevin Love sweepstakes. And I'll actually start with you. I'll start with you, Matt, on this. If the Bulls had gotten Kevin Love, do you think that would have changed some things for the franchise there in a positive or negative way?
I mean, if instead of Melo, they get, and instead of Pau, they get Kevin Love, and they pair Kevin Love with Derrick Rose and Joakim, maybe you got something there. But you were giving up Jimmy to get Kevin Love. As far as what, you know, from what I understood and from those trade rumors that we were hearing, you couldn't keep all of the pieces that the Bulls had that were still getting kind of tired and kind of on their last legs, but not quite. And the younger pieces of that, like Jimmy, they couldn't keep all that stuff and add Kevin Love. So you were giving up something. And to me, Derek and his knees and all of his injuries, I mean, Kevin Love at that time, I was still a great prime player. And I, at the time, probably would have loved the move. I don't think it gets the Bulls any further than they got.
Man, it's very few people are more in tune with the Bulls than me. And that's the Kevin Love thing. I don't recall that being ever a serious conversation.
So
I don't know. Do you remember this, Matt? I don't.
Yes,
I do. Yeah.
Mark Stein and Brian Windhorst were the two I remember that were on it a lot. And this was around late July of 2014. And Matt is right that Jimmy Butler was a proposed piece. There was talk about maybe Taj being part of that deal, or even Joakim Noah, who was coming off of a season where he finished fourth in MVP voting.
Wow. Well, absolutely Noah for at that point when he was fourth in MVP fourth in MVP voting, first team All NBA. That's a no-brainer that you don't make that trade at that
point. Not just first team All Defense NBA, but Defensive Player of the Year as well.
Exactly.
So why
would you trade that? So I do want to step back 1 second because this is a very important point. Jimmy Butler in 2014 turned down $48 million.
It was 4 years, 40. 44.
4 years, 40. Right. Turned that down. Jimmy Butler it took the biggest jump from 2013-14 season to 2014-15. Out of every beat writer I've talked to said that was the biggest jump a player has ever made in their estimation. Casey Johnson, I asked this too. Anyone who was covering the team at that time, all agreed that that was the biggest increase. Like people kind of, again, rewrite the history on Jimmy Butler. He was nowhere near the player that he was in 2014-15 at the end of 2013-14. He was a 13 PER player, which is actually below average on the offensive end in most estimation. He went from 13 to 21, which is like unheard of.
Yeah.
So there's no way that Minnesota would have given up Kevin Love for Jimmy Butler, who was going into who just turned down a contract, mind you, from the Bulls that I thought was fair at the time. There's no way that deal would have been done.
And I actually, in our previous episode where we looked at 2008 to the end of the 2014 regular season, I made the point with C-Dub from Ball on Bulls that I was in that camp of actually selling high on Joakim Noah, believe it or not, in the summer of 2014. And that was what I was actually kind of hoping for, was that they would part with him in a deal for Kevin Love to get a little younger. So I was in that camp, maybe just a lone wolf, but that's something that I would have done.
I mean, I don't think you were wrong. Like, yeah. That would have created riots in the streets of Chicago.
Yeah.
In the year of 2014, there was no one in this city more loved than Joakim Noah. You know, like the Hawks were in a down year in between cups with Kane and Taser, but like nobody that year when Joakim was fourth in MVP voting and DPOY and first team all, nobody was more beloved in the city of Chicago than Joakim. If you traded him then, even though it probably would have been wise, they would have burned down the United Center.
It wouldn't have been wise. Well, hold on a second. Well, in retrospect, yeah, it looks wise. There's never been a first-team All-NBA player to be traded in the last decade. Traded for Kevin Love.
But Fred Tibbs just wore down Joakim and played him so many minutes that season. The writing was on the wall.
Hey, no one knew the wall was that close that Joakim was going to run into there. I definitely brought the wall closer.
How's that medicine taste? your own flavored?
I'm not even going to acknowledge that.
Just to point this out, though, you would have been trading a first-team All-NBA guy for a second-team All-NBA guy, really. So it wouldn't have been, I think, that egregious. Because you would have been.
Matt said it right. Noah was the most popular. He represented the city. He was the most popular player in Chicago.
Who gives a shit? Here's the thing. You don't trade a player who's beloved.
You think you're going to trade Khalil Mack?
No, because Khalil Mack is like a once in a generational player. Noah's not a once in a generational player. No, he's not. I mean, even that season, he wasn't.
In 2014,
he wasn't, but he wasn't a once in a generational talent. And so, like, that's where I can draw the line. I know where Joakim Noah was to me. That was always going to be his ceiling, and I felt that even then. You can look back. I got ripped by Cap when he had that show on that failed radio station that summer. What was it? 87.7 The Game.
87.7 The Game. Yeah.
And I tweeted into Cap and Haw, and I said I would give up Joakim Noah. I think I said Taj Gibson and a bunch of draft picks for Kevin Love, and they said, Bulls are never going to give up Noah. Stop it. And
well,
I just
– well, that makes sense.
Not necessarily that it was a bad idea, but the Bulls at that time would not give up Joe. But you look at Kevin Love's stats in 13-14, which was an All-NBA season, 77 games. He averaged 26 and 12.5 and 4.4 assists. Like, monster year. And
he wasn't
four years younger than Joakim.
Like that,
but
that
he wasn't
me
defensively in the same league. He and the Bulls were all about defense, as you said earlier, Matt. That was a defensive first team, and trading Noah, who was defensive player of the year in this city, would have been the dumbest move.
Well, I don't know if it was would have been dumbest, but I think actually though, one thing it would have done, it might have pissed off Thibs even more had they made that trade.
Oh my God, he would.
One thing I do think.
Oh my God.
I can't even imagine.
Brett and I just both said, "Oh my God!"
Yeah.
That
I do want to bring up something really quick though. Also, sure. If you go back to that time, let's just go back to the summer 2014 and look back where we were. So Rose gets hurt in the first game of 2012 playoffs. He then misses all the rest of that playoffs, all the 2013 and all of 2014 season. I don't think this is ever talked about enough. Like the MVP of a team. When has that ever happened? That some
John
player,
Paxson talks about it plenty.
Yeah, we still
not
hear
enough.
About it.
Not enough.
Well,
because
here's
it's
the thing
insane.
With that.
Insane. It's insane to think that.
So my whole thing with that, and this is kind of a separate discussion. I feel like when that happens, you got to start creating your own luck. Like, you got to start making moves to try and prepare for the future a little bit there. Like, that was my biggest concern was they were never kind of setting themselves up for
what if. It's like,
for the what if.
They got lucky with a 1.7% chance of Rhodes, and then they got lucky some more when he turned into an unpredictably phenomenal player and the youngest MVP in league history. And then they got unlucky when he hurt himself and was an injury-prone player. It balances out. They can't use the excuses of the injury and take credit for the luck of what Derrick Rose was and how they got him.
Well, hold on a second. No. He got hurt before the first
did
year
I just
of
leave?
Fight.
Did I just leave you speechless, Fred? Because I'm pretty sure I summed up the last 10 years of both pretty succinctly.
That is not luck. When he gets hurt before the first year of a five-year deal, and he misses the playoffs for the first 3 years of that five-year deal. I mean, first 2 years. Because it's so easy to say that, Matt, right now, just like, oh, they should have traded and they should have looked ahead. You can't look ahead. You're in year three of a max deal that you don't know if Derrick Rose, still didn't know if he was the MVP guy.
Here's the thing. The best executives, though, to me, always are making that calculated decision. So if you see after 2 years Derek getting hurt, I'm just saying, like, I'm not saying you would have traded Derek Rose. That's not what I'm saying. I think you try and build a team to get to that next step without him, or try to prepare for the fact that, well, he's not going to be around a lot, so I need to surround him with a lot of talent. That's what I'm saying.
Well,
the Thunder just traded Russell Westbrook, for crying out loud. Like,
at 32.
Okay, fair enough. But still, if you decide that what the best move is for your organization is to part ways with a player, then you do it. The Bulls did it a year or maybe two too late with Derek, and they did it a year or maybe two too late with Jimmy. I mean, they sold high on Jimmy, so at least they got that. But they could have sold higher had they sold him a year prior with another year left on his cheaper deal.
Let's take this argument out. When should they have traded Derrick Rose before they did? When was that deal in place? And what would you have gotten for Derrick Rose? It's insanity to argue this. It is complete insanity. It's easy to say now, but if you go back to that time, Derrick Rose missed an entire season in 2013. In 2014, he played 9 games and looked great. He's out for the rest of the season. There is no deal in the league
I'm not getting into
Derrick Rose. Period.
Yeah, no, I'm not gonna say that I would have traded Derrick Rose. So my point was trading the Joakim Noah type player, the guy that I think hit his ceiling, and go find that next piece that maybe you could start building around, or if you play Derrick in a limited role, maybe he works a little bit better with that player. That's why I would have been okay with Kevin Love. Yeah. That's the point I'm making.
I don't know how we got down that road. We were talking about hypothetical Joakim and Jimmy for Kevin Love, and then Fred started crying about how the Bulls don't get enough of a break because Derrick got hurt.
Oh, Matt.
Oh, wait. I do know how we got here. Fred's on this podcast.
But that's why we want Fred on this podcast, man. That's a good discussion. I love it.
Thanks.
So on a scale of 1 to 5, let's rate the trades during this period. We'll start with you, Matt.
All right. I'm gonna give a little bit of a higher grade than my first two rounds in part one, because of the Otto for Jabari Bobby trade that we just saw earlier this year, and because of the draft night trade for Jimmy, I will give them a 3. It's a generous 3. There's a lot of garbage that we've been over. We don't know. We don't need to rehash all the terrible trades that they've made in this span for 14 to 19. But collectively, those two trades, I will lighten up my Grinch heart a little bit and give them a 3, because those were two home run trades.
All right. How about you, Fred?
Yeah, I give their trades a 5. I think getting Zach LaVine and Lauri Markkanen for Butler, and especially in retrospect to how it was viewed by the fan base, how it caused so much outrage. It's just like, it was clearly they won that trade, especially where I think that Lauri Markkanen's going. And in fact, also that you got to realize too, it helped them to get Wendell Carter Jr. You basically tanked that season. And it's to me a clear homer. I feel that Wendell Carter Jr., Lauri Markkanen, and Zach LaVine are enough to be the core of a championship contender. So how else could I rank it besides the 5? I don't like them apples.
Oh, championship core. I'm gonna give it a 4. I think that the Jimmy Butler trade, the Otto Porter trade, I think were two really solid deals. The only thing that maybe keeps me from giving it a little bit higher, like a 4.5, is the trade that involved Taj Gibson for basically campaign. So to recap the trades again, Fred gives them a 5 out of 5, Matt a 3 out of 5, and I give them a 4 out of 5. So let's get into the coaching decisions to wrap this up. During this 5-year period of Bulls basketball, the team has gone through 3 different head coaches. It started with Tom Thibodeau, who they hired in 2010. After enjoying much success early in his tenure, tension between Thibodeau and Garpak started to mount. Much to Thibs' chagrin, the front office started to put minutes restrictions on oft-injured players like Derrick Rose and Joakim Noah. There also was friction from Gar Forman's decision to fire assistant Ron Adams prior to the 2014 season. These factors and more set up the 2015 campaign as Thibodeau's last chance at redemption. Despite a year filled with drama and injuries, the Bulls managed to win 50 games and lock up the 3rd seed in the East. After dispatching the Milwaukee Bucks in round 1, the team took on LeBron James and the Cleveland Cavaliers. After taking a 2-1 series lead, LeBron hit a game-winning buzzer beater in game 4 to tie the series. The Bulls would drop the next 2 games and exit in the 2nd round. During the 6th and final game, the team actually looked defeated and somewhat uninspired, as if they knew the writing was on the wall for their head coach. Nearly a week after the series, Thibodeau was fired. Even before his dismissal, rumors swirled that the Bulls were interested in Iowa State head coach Fred Hoiberg. The speculation made perfect sense. Hoiberg was a former Bull, and he had a connection with GM Gar Forman, who served as an assistant coach at Iowa State in the 1990s. While enjoying success at the collegiate ranks, Hoiberg's pace and space offense made him a target of several NBA teams, including the Golden State Warriors in 2014. The Bulls hired him in May 2015, signing him to a lucrative 5-year, $25 million contract. Hoiberg was viewed as a stark change from the hard-charging Thibodeau. He was sold as an offensive innovator and a master communicator. Unfortunately, he was neither during his tenure with the Bulls. His offenses were lackluster throughout his tenure. The team ranked in the bottom third in offensive efficiency during his 3+ seasons as coach. Sure, Gar Packs didn't always give him the best players to suit his system, but part of coaching in the NBA is to adapt. In his first season as head coach, Hoiberg inherited almost the exact same roster as the previous season. He managed to lead the team to just 42 wins and 23rd in offensive efficiency. The same squad managed to win 50 games and was 11th in offensive efficiency the year before under Thibodeau. Those communication skills never bared fruit either. Hoiberg often struggled to get his message across to veteran players. He notably clashed with Jimmy Butler several times in his tenure, which included a moment where Butler publicly pined for the days when Thibs would coach him harder. There also was the bizarre controversy over Joakim Noah's role prior to the 2016 season. Hoiberg decided to bench Noah, who had been the team's starting center and a fan favorite for nearly 8 years. Instead of handling it behind closed doors, Hoiberg told NBA reporter Zach Lowe that Noah lobbied to come off the bench to help the team. But just hours after the interview went public, Noah told the media he did not agree to come off the bench at all, causing unnecessary drama throughout the year. With a lack of offensive identity and woeful defense, it was clear that change was needed. In December 2018, Gar Packs pulled the plug on Hoiberg with a full season and a half left on his contract. They bumped assistant head coach Jim Boylan into the role. While the move wasn't shocking, the decision to not name him interim head coach was surprising. John Paxson seemed committed to Boylan long-term from the onset. Things didn't go smoothly at the start for Boylan. He immediately stressed his no-nonsense style, which rubbed some of the young core the wrong way. Following a blowout loss to the Celtics at home just weeks into his tenure, Boylan and the players clashed over practicing the next day. The near mutiny made headlines, and it seemed the situation wasn't going to improve. Fortunately, as the season went on, Boylan started to win over his young core, especially Zach LaVine and Lauri Markkanen. However, it didn't necessarily result in wins. While there was a bright spot in February, Boylan coached the Bulls to just 17 wins in 58 games. Oddly, it was enough for Gar Packs to avoid a coaching search and give Boylan a 3-year contract extension to be their head coach. The coaching decisions in the past 5 years have raised many Bulls fans' eyebrows. For their sake, hopefully the front office is right about Boylan, because as players like LaVine, Markkanen, Wendell Carter Jr., and Kobe White continue to grow, they'll need the right leadership and guidance to reach their ceilings. All right, I'm going to start with Fred here. Why do you think the relationship between Thibodeau and the front office soured?
Oh, that's a clear answer. They put Noah and Rose on a minute limit in 2014-15 season. That's what led to the major reason. Well, two reasons. They fired Ron Adams, who was obviously beloved by Tibbs, and some players within the organization liked him. Some did not.
And he went on. And where is he now? One of the most highly valued assistants on a team that's won titles in 3 of the last 5 years.
Didn't he just leave? I think he just left there. Mm-hmm. He's out of there. Well, yeah, he was so valuable for the Bulls that in his last season with the Bulls, they were 8th in defense. And then when he left the next year, they fell all the way to number 2. So, yeah, he was incredible defensive, did a great job. Just no doubt about it. There's nothing more overrated than an assistant NBA coach. It's like, this is even a joke that we're talking about Ron Adams.
Okay. Okay. But okay.
Yeah, he did a great job. He's well respected in the league, and a lot of writers love him because he loves giving inside info. So we all know that he loves giving all the writers, hey, you know, Tibbs wanted Green. We all know that. Yeah, I got it. He's got a great PR team. Rod Adams is the best. But what were we talking about now? How did I get on Ron Adams?
Why did the relationship between Tibbs and the front office sour?
Number one reason is that reason. So here's what happened. The Bulls, rightly so, said, we're tired of you playing Noah, you know, 40 minutes on back-to-backs, averaging 40 minutes in the month of December 2012. And in 2013, game 60, when he goes out, everybody's like, poor Tibbs, when his own idiotic playing habits led to, you know, Noah getting hurt. So they said, you know what, you're not going to do that with Rose. He's on a 32 minutes per game minute limit, and so is Noah. And you're not going off of that. So what does he do? He goes and complains to his buddy Jeff Van Gundy, who on national TV embarrasses the organization by saying, they're meddling with him. They're meddling with him. When all the Bulls were trying to do in the front office was to get with, you know, modern coaches like Steve Kerr and Greg Popovich, who had saw the importance of rest. I don't even know why we're arguing it now, but, yeah. You know, and why Tibbs is talking about, you know, how much Jordan played in the mid-90s. So, yeah, they meddled with him because there's three things I saw firsthand that I will never forget. Well, obviously, we all saw the Rose thing, right? He's in the game with the Bulls up double digits. It's arguable if he should have been in the game when he hurt his ACL. Regardless, it happened. The second thing I saw was I went out to Washington. I think this was 2013, so it might have been before this era that you're talking about. And it was probably a March game. And Taj Gibson, luckily in Washington, the fan base sucks, so I was able to get like 10 rows up for about $50. And Taj Gibson's in the game, and I've never seen a player gut out a performance in the first half. Like, it was clear he was in intense pain for the whole first half that he played. He didn't come out in the second half, and he didn't play a game for the remainder of the season. So I think this was 2013, if memory serves me correct. I'll never forget that because I remember saying to myself, why the heck is this guy in this game? He shouldn't be anywhere near the court. He was clear he was hurt. But later on, Taj Gibson admitted that Tibbs encouraged players to play hurt. And then the last thing I saw was in game 6 against Milwaukee with the Bulls up 50-plus points against Milwaukee in 2015. And he's got Joakim Noah playing in the fourth quarter. And at that game, I said, this guy is dead to me. And I don't care how good of a coach he is. He's clearly a great coach. He's clearly a hard worker. There's a lot of things to love about Tibbs. But there's coaches that part of the job of being a good coach is protecting the player from themselves. Like there's warriors. Guys like Noah, they'll play hurt. They'll play. You have to protect them from themselves. I saw one guy play an entire game on a torn ACL when I was in high school. The coach should never let him play. Everybody seen the famous scene from Hoosiers? Remember that scene in Hoosiers where he goes up for the layup and he tears open his shoulder against the glass, and he's like, what do you mean? Patch him up. Get him back out there. And he thinks twice, and he says, no, you're coming out of the game. Tibbs didn't have that. He didn't have that. I need to protect the player. He looked at every regular season game like it was a game 7. For that, he deserved to be fired. And when he went to Minnesota, no one talks about this in his first season there. God. Back-to-back games to end the season with Towns and Wiggins, who led the team in total minutes. Towns, in a game that they were a lottery team. He played him 40 minutes,
Matt,
40-plus minutes.
Matt, you can hit Fred's off switch any second now.
Well, I'm going to do that. I'm going to do that now. Fred, I think you got your point across. How about you, Matt?
Oh, here we go.
Why did the relationship between Tibbs and the front office fail? It's because Tibbs wanted power and the front office wanted to interject on that power. He wanted to say, get out of here. Let me run my team. Don't tell me how to do my job. Don't tell me how many minutes they should play. Don't tell me how to run my team. Don't tell me how to run my practices. And the Bulls front office said, hey, we'd like to give you some of our input about how many minutes your teammates, your players should play and how you should run your practices. Simple. Done. A power struggle. That's all it was. It's exactly the same simple answer as Jerry Krause versus Phil Jackson. Tom Thibodeau wanted to build a us-against-the-world mentality, and the world includes your bosses in the front office. For Phil, it worked great. For Tibbs, it worked slightly less good for a shorter amount of time, but still pretty darn good when you saw those results of Tom Thibodeau, a first-time head coach, being one of the winningest coaches in NBA history. Over when you're talking about winning percentage in his span of years coaching the Bulls. That was his system. That was Phil's system. Us against the world. The world includes management. Management can fuck off. Bulls management and ownership has never liked that. That's what happened. Simple as that.
No, Matt, did you feel that the front office was wrong from imposing a minutes limit on Rose and Noah? Yes or no?
I'm going to answer your question with another question. Who would I
what
rather?
Do you mean? Answer my question. I just asked you a question. Now I'll answer your question. Yes or no? Were the Bulls right in imposing a minutes limit on Derrick Rose and Joakim Noah?
No.
Oh, for God's sakes.
No.
Oh,
I mean, you can't predict any of that stuff. And the whole, like, oh, Derrick should have been in that playoff game in game one in 2012. Guess what? Derrick Rose, with that frame and the way that he put torque on that body, he was getting hurt either way. It wasn't a matter of if, it was a matter of when, and it was coming. So I do not blame Tibbs for that at all. At all. And when you're talking about who gets more of a pass, who deserves credit, who deserves blame, and you're asking me pick one hand or the other, Tom Thibodeau or the Bulls front office of the last 16 years, you bet your ass I'm defending Tom Thibodeau. Yes, the game has passed by some of his strategies of defense first, and yes, his stint in Minnesota turned out to be a failure because he didn't get through to his guys. Yes, he is a hard-nosed coach, and some of the same reasons that I have concerns about Jim Boylan working out, but Tom Thibodeau brought the team from a 40-win team to a 62-win team.
No, he didn't. No, he
yes.
Didn't. Here's who brought him.
Some of that Derrick was Derrick Rose.
Derrick Rose and Joakim Noah and Taj Gibson and all those free agents, Kyle Korver, that they signed in that offseason. Those are the guys that deserve the credit for it. Yes, Tom Thibodeau absolutely deserves some credit.
Some?
But you can't.
Orchestrating the best.
I don't think he deserves most of the credit. He doesn't deserve more than Derrick Rose, who in year three became an MVP. You think, as Noah said, let me use his quote, you think it's because of a coach we worked this hard? As Noah put it very succinctly, he felt that Tom took way too much credit for that team, and I agree with him. None of those guys wanted anything to do with Thibodeau by the end of his tenure here. He was great for a young team, but by the end of the team, Rip Hamilton talked about, I never ever had to go ice my knees after a shoot. Before a shoot around. You don't think that had an effect on those guys?
Great signing. Another great signing.
I wouldn't cite.
Oh, yeah. I really care about Rick
Yeah,
Hamilton.
We needed a shooting guard. We already had Tom Korver on the roster.
Give me a joke. Give me a break, Red.
I am talking truth here, and I'll tell you right now, Kyle Korver was on a stinking roster playing 20 minutes per game behind a bung, but like Keith Bogans. What the heck is going on here? Yeah, but a Tibbs did it.
I'm assemble my friends among Bulls Nation who think that Tibbs got done dirty on his way out of town with the way that they treated him. And you assemble your group of friends who would rather take the front office's side over Tom Thibodeau's side. And we'll meet in the parking lot and we'll see who wins that.
And I'll get my ass kicked, of course, because I'm the only person in town willing to say the fact that guy, I'd hire him to fire him immediately afterwards because Noah's career was cut short by him, and so was Rose's. I firmly believe that Noah – it's not a coincidence that the guy is done at 30. And,
right.
And it's not a coincidence. Was he a great coach? Yes. Did he put winning ahead of long-term health of his players? Yes.
Real quick, and I want to get to Gar Forman's boy, Fred Hoiberg, real quick. He went 115 and 155 as Bulls head coach, not including his lone playoff series. Starting with you, Matt, how would you describe the Hoiberg experience?
As a fan, it was milquetoast. That's the word I always like to use to describe Fred Hoiberg. Another one is he is the Ned Flanders of the NBA. He was the antithesis of Tom Thibodeau, and that's why they hired him. The Bulls have a track record of doing this. They overcorrect every time they hire a coach and bring in a new one. Fred was a pushover. He was a yes man. He was a, oh, excuse me, pardon me, sorry, let me offer you an apology when you wronged me kind of guy, who was the opposite of Tibbs. But as far as the basketball we saw, the Fred Hoiberg experience never got off the ground because the front office was too freaking stupid to build him a roster that made sense to like work with Fred Hoiberg's strengths and what he was trying to accomplish. So was I ever high on Fred Hoiberg? No. Did I think he had what it took to coach at the NBA level? No. But he certainly didn't get any help from his bosses.
Well, I'm going to completely disagree here. I think Fred had plenty of talent. I thought the 2016-17 team, I would agree. Yeah, it wasn't the perfect talent for his system. I don't give a crap about his system. I don't think the best coaches say, hey, here's my system, and you get me talent to play in my system. I don't agree with that. I think you look at your players, and you determine what their skill sets are, and you develop a system that works best for those players. The best coaches are that way. From Bill Belichick and the NFL to Greg Popovich, they're not going to run a rigid system. Look at Popovich. Look how he changed over the years when he brought in different players. It's a lot of adapting your system to the talent of your players. And all this stuff about, like, well, he never had a three-point shooting team. Yeah, he didn't have Ryan Anderson. Maybe we should have signed Ryan Anderson for 4 years and $20 million like the Houston Rockets did. It's not perfect, but you had players on that team that were good enough three-point shooters, and for whatever reason, they didn't perform in his system. Like, Niko Mirotić had 1 year where he shot 39%. He had a very good year under Fred, actually. Fred's first year in the league was probably, in my opinion, Nico's best year overall. But then the next year, he was a complete and utter disaster for 4 months. So part of your job as a coach is putting your players in a position to succeed. I don't think Fred did that. I don't feel like he fell in love with guys like Paul Zipser that played far too many minutes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Who fell in love with Paul Zipser? Because I believe the answer to that question is Gar Foreman.
But Paul Zipser has the typical shelf life of a second round pick. They play for 1 or 2 years and then they're off to their life's work.
You cannot pass the Paul Zipser buck to Fred Hoiberg. Fred,
Matt, you can't act like Paul Zipser. He was like the 48th pick for his career. Paul Zipser was about as good as you should expect for that position in the draft. You don't expect guys that are rotation players in the second round. Most of them don't even show up in the league.
I wonder why he was getting minutes. Maybe because Fred's the pushover yes man coach, and Gar, who was the first one to sing Paul Zipser's praises, is the one who was telling him to play Fred. He was telling Fred to play Paul Zipser.
Nobody was telling him to play Paul
blind.
Zipser.
Fred, no, you are no, so blind,
him,
man.
No, nobody was telling him to play Paul Zipser. I asked. I was lucky enough to meet Pax, and I demanded to know. I demanded to know Pax. You know me. I met him in last preseason game when I heard that when they had just Jabari Parker was put to the bench. I go, Pax, I want to know, was that your decision or was that Fred's? Because if it's your decision, I'm going to tell you a horrible decision. It was Fred's. Mm-hmm. It was
Why
Fred's.
Is John going to tell you that?
And I'm definitely 100% sure that John Paxson tells you the truth all the time, Fred.
John Paxson is a truth teller. He tells everyone the truth.
Oh, boy. Before we start grading here, I do want to get your thoughts real quickly, guys, on Jim Boylan. And I'll start with you, Fred. Do you think Jim Boylan deserved to stay on after this season, or should the Bulls have done a coaching search?
No, my general opinion is I think coaches are vastly overrated in the NBA. Do I think Jim Boylan's a great coach? No. There's like five coaches in the NBA who I think are great. There's a lot who are basically in the middle, and then there's a couple that are awful. I don't think he's an awful coach. I thought his start here was a complete disaster. How he handled Parker was a joke. But, you know, as I stated on Twitter, and I still firmly believe, you don't judge somebody on their first 30 days on the job. I don't care what field it is. And yeah, it was a complete embarrassment. It was really bad. But I think it was clear that, in my opinion, the two things are most important for the coach. Do they play hard for you? And do they listen to you? Or have they tuned you out? You know, those are the two most important things. I think the team played hard. It was clear in February they were responding to him. I don't feel like they tuned him out. And I think, you know, Matt, you're probably in better position to get this in your conversations with Ryan. I think he's kind of, for the most part, beloved by a lot of players on that team. And I don't think he's a bad coach. I don't think he's great. But you know, I don't feel like there was anybody else out there I would have preferred, you know, to bring him in for.
Oof. Yes, the Bulls should have done a coaching search. I mean, come on. That's part of their freaking job. The fact that they just handed Jim Boylan that extension when they didn't need to disgusts me. Don't get me wrong. I like Jim Boylan, the person. And there are parts of me as a fan who want to believe in his, it's not the old school way, it's the right way kind of stuff. Like when he did, like when he was at NBA Summer League and did that interview for XM, you know, Sirius NBA Radio. That's the kind of stuff that I like to hear as a Chicago sports fan. And part of it I agree with. Since when did doing things the old school way, the hard way, suddenly turn into this thing where it's like it's a negative? I understand what Jim Boylan means when he says that kind of stuff, which is why sometimes I feel bad when we laugh at his 5 second sound bites and his trigger words that we all have just turned into jokes. The spirit that pulls across the chest, the toughness, all that. Some of it, I understand what he's saying, and I do believe that it's not all bullshit. But I understand why people poke fun at it. Because these days in the NBA, it's not about grit, toughness, and spirit. It's about, like, all right, we're playing Moneyball NBA, and it's all about analytics, and it's all about the most efficient ways to outscore your opponent every night. And Jim Boylan and John Paxson, his boss, don't seem to care a whole lot about any of that kind of stuff. Which is why, thank God, they went out and hired Chris Fleming to help Jim Boylan out this season, which is another good thing that the front office did this offseason. And I like the Roy Rogers addition as well. But, I mean, did Jim Boylan deserve to stay on? If you want to say he deserved a full season as opposed to taking over for a half a year and being an interim coach that they just tossed aside, maybe you can say that. But to give that dude a 3-year extension this summer when they absolutely did not have to, and they also did not quietly, discreetly conduct a coaching search, ridiculous. Do your job.
He was under contract. This is another thing I don't understand.
Oh, right, because a Bulls coach being under contract has always prevented them from firing that coach and hiring a new one in the past, right? They didn't pay Tom Thibodeau and Fred Hoiberg at the same time. They didn't pay Fred Hoiberg and Jim Boylan at the same time.
You don't do a coaching search when your head coach is under contract. It's common sense. You don't do that because you're sending a message to your team that this guy's not going to be here.
Right. They didn't have to name him head coach.
Yeah, and also the contract they gave him was really just a clerical move to give him some guaranteed money for taking the job this past season. So, like, they went in there, did that, gave him 1 year that basically was just handing him extra cash, but not even that much money.
I'm not talking about them restructuring his contract while the season was going on.
I'm going to Fred's point, because Fred said while he was still under contract, but really, I mean, it would have been 1 year. You could toss aside 1 year. That always happens in the NBA. They would have fired him and then done a coaching search.
The 3-year extension came later this summer.
That came after.
I'd like to hit, just let's follow this through. You guys want to do a coaching search. When does that coaching search start? Who do you bring in what month?
Starts when the season ends.
You got a head coach under contract and you're bringing
you
in.
You fire him.
Oh, you want, so that's different. You want him fired.
Yes. Okay.
I believe you've already made a commitment to him. He's your head coach for next year. There's no coaching search.
They were throwing an extra $500,000 to him to help pay for his divorce. That's all it was. Like, that, I mean, that was even brought up many times by some of the different beat writers, and I know Kat brought it up, and, I mean, they were doing it just to give him a little extra cash for being the coach this past season.
Well, because it was embarrassing how much he was paid relative to the other coaches.
An assistant coach who got a promotion. I mean, he was on
that's all it was.
Coach's salary.
Yeah,
come on.
So you had to pay him as a head coach, which they did, right thing to do. If you believe he's the head coach.
Right. You can bump up his salary for that year without officially and doubling down on he is our new head coach. He's not finishing out the season as the head coach. He's not our interim head coach. He is our new chosen head coach. They didn't have to say all that, Fred.
He was already chosen to be the head coach. They already made that decision. My whole point is here. There's a fallacy in the question is that you only do a search if you fire him. That's the problem. If you don't believe he's the coach, you fire him and then you do your search. You don't do the search while he's under contract.
Yeah, literally, you don't give him the extension. You say thanks for holding down the fort, and then you do a coaching search. Because you were saying, they don't want to pay him, and you know he's under contract. The Bulls fire head coaches all the time, and then pay them to not coach.
Well, and real quick, I just want to clarify for listeners. So there was two extensions really given to Jim Boylan. There was a contract restructure during the season that was given to Boylan that tacked on a year with a little extra money. After the season, that's where they gave him that 3-year extension.
Yes, and everybody's head blew up when it was clear they already made a commitment to him.
I took issue with that, Fred. You know, to play devil's advocate a little bit, when Bulls fans flipped out and thought that he got an extension, all they did was restructure his deal.
Yeah,
I was like, come on, Bulls fans, you're smarter than this.
Fair enough. That was very well done on your part.
All right, I'm
not always the bad guy.
Let's grade the coaching decisions in totality on a scale of 1 to 5, and I'll start with you, Matt.
One. I mean, when you think about Okay, it's 14 to 19. So they don't get credit for hiring Tibbs because that happened way back in 2010.
Correct.
In this era, I give them I take away points for the way that the Tibbs era ended. And Fred will say that that was mostly Tibbs' fault. I will say that I think there was blame on both sides. And the fact that Tibbs took the high road and the front office just wrote that scathing commentary about Tibbs and why he was fired on his way out of town. You know, don't let the door hit you where the good Lord split you. That was a terrible look for this organization. And maybe part of the reason contributing to this whole perception is reality. Paxton doesn't claims it doesn't exist. Why does nobody want to come here? Why does nobody respect this organization? Because of shit like that. So I'm you know, the Tibbs era from 14 until the end, that's no points for me. Replacing him with milquetoast Ned Flanders, Fred Hoiberg, and then not giving Fred the proper roster, a whole lot more no points. The Jim Boylan transition, where the Bulls were the laughingstock of the NBA, not a whole lot of points there either. I give him 1 point for at least doubling down and being firmly confident about Jim Boylan being their guy, and that at least being one thing that they do not waver on recently, which is the thing that drives the fan base crazy. Don't talk to us in doublespeak. Tell us what you freaking mean. They certainly at least have been very firm in their confidence in Jim Boylan. I will give them a point for that.
All right, let's start out with one thing. There's nothing more low road than being told by your bosses you're going to play Rose and Noah 32 minutes per game. Then you go run to your blabbering idiot buddy, Jeff Van Gundy. They're messing with me. I want to play him 40 minutes per game. They're telling me 32 minutes per game. That's the epitome of low road. And then that idiot goes on national TV and embarrasses the whole organization. That's where the road started low, with Tibbs complaining that he was being meddled with the time, when they were absolutely right to make that decision. But I don't want to go down that road again. Firing him was absolutely the right decision. They give a 5+ for it at that point, especially knowing that the reaction from the Ditka fans all over the city would be so outrageous. How would you fire the Mr. Defense? It was a good decision. Hiring Fred's a very smart guy. He's a very intelligent. He knows basketball in and out. I never questioned that. He's not a leader of men. He's not a leader. He's a college coach. He was walked over by the team. It just was not a good situation. That was not a good hire in retrospect. So I give that a 2. Jim Boylan, I think it's out. It's clearly I find a lot of the stuff that he does endearing. I think he's Tibbs with a little bit more moderation.
Personality.
I find a lot of similarities to Tibbs and Jim Boylan. And
oh, they're carbon
copies.
It's
not like I didn't dislike Tibbs. Yeah, they're exactly the same. It's not. There were a lot of things I liked about Tibbs, but
right.
The things I'm putting is.
It's like
I don't want to go on a road again.
When you go to Thanksgiving dinner and there's like two uncles that look very similar, but like one of them you're afraid to talk to, and one of them is like super nice.
They're just rubbing whipped cream on each
Tibbs
other.
That is Tibbs and Jim Boylan. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, the coaches in this era have not been done very well, and so incomplete with Boylan. Overall, I'll give it a 2.9.
All right. Okay. That's. For you, I think that's fantastic, actually.
Thanks, Matt.
I'm with Matt on this one. I'm going to go with a 1, and I think for pretty obvious reasons. I think the way that the situation ended with Tibbs, I think could have been handled a little bit better. Fred, I never really was inspired by as being the head coach of the Bulls, and Boylan is sort of incomplete, and that's why I do give it a 1, because I think as the season went on, this past season, we saw that he started to win over that roster a bit. So I give him some credit for that. And it seems like the Bulls did identify him as their coach. I don't necessarily like the situation with not having some type of coaching search and making it a fair shake. So I will give it a 1 out of 5. So let me tally all this up when we look at everything. So Fred, you scored the Bulls in this era a 15.5 out of 20.
Because you gave the
sounds even more ridiculous what he added up.
Yeah, you gave a
are we sure?
Yes, a 3.8 out of 5 for the drafts, 3.8 out of 5 for free agency a 5 out of 5 for the trades made during that period, and then you gave them a 2.9 out of 5 for the coaching decisions. Matt, you gave them a 6 out of 20. A 1 for... 1 for 3 of these categories, of course. Free agency, drafts, and coaching decisions. You gave them a very generous 3 for the trades they made. I gave them a 10.5 out of 20 because I gave them a 3 for drafts, 2.5 for free agency, 4 for trades, and a 1 for coaching decisions. Just want to get final thoughts before we sign off here. And I'll start with you. I'll start with you, Fred. Do you think they're actually right now turning this thing around to where they can get into title contention?
Absolutely. I know there's probably many listeners giggling at this statement, but I firmly believe it to be true. I think even regardless of what happened in this past draft with the addition of White, I think the core of a title contender, I'm not saying that they would win a title, but at least a contender in Levine, Markkanen, and Wendell Carter Jr. were there and put in place and building around them with solid players like Thad Young, solid role players like that, would be enough in a few years to be a contender for a title. I firmly believe it. Now, with that, you know, some people I know are laughing, but Golden State in 2012 won 24 games or 23 games, something like that. No one expected within 3 years they'd be winning a title. Growth from players at this age in year 3, 4, 5 happens and often exponentially. It's just a matter of how high is the ceiling for Markkanen and how high is the ceiling for Levine and how high is the ceiling for Wendell Carter Jr. I think the ceiling is pretty high. So I'm a big believer that things are turned around. And I do believe that this team can win a title in the next few years. Does that answer your question?
Yes. All right, over to Matt.
Wow. So, Fred, what? So you're prophesizing title contentions instead of winning titles now? Is that what we're doing?
No.
Feel really good about this young core contending for titles. But so what? I thought we were already guaranteed a rally in Grand Park in 2021.
Have to put my prophet hat on. I don't want it. There's two different things. There's Fred the prophet and Fred the critical analyst.
Gutless.
Which one do you want?
Gutless.
I think I said the same thing.
The Fred that yells at Bulls fans on Twitter all day, every day to pound sand if they try to look at this team through a scope of realism. That's the Fred I came here to argue with. Come on. Oh, they could be title contenders in a couple of years. What happened to you?
I think it's still consistent with my prediction. Okay. What was my number? What was my number again? What did I have?
I'm not talking to you about it.
15.5.
15.5? Darn it. I was hoping then on 17, because you know my motto.
Don't get him started.
7.
Yeah, we know. We know, Fred. I'm pretty sure everyone in fucking Turkmenistan knows. All right. Do I see this rebuild resulting in title contention? Realistically, no. Would I like to? Hell yeah. Am I some days more optimistic than others that it might happen if players like Zach and Lowry and Wendell reach their full potential and reach their ceilings? Yes, I think there is a reality where that happens and they somehow become better at their jobs and build the right pieces around them and find the right coach that speaks to them and gets them to buy in. And everything works out beautifully in the world of Fred and Disneyland and blowjobs for everyone. Yeah, that would be great. Do I realistically think that that is on the horizon? No.
What are we talking?
I like his land. I'm not going to lie. I really like this land.
I thought this was a family podcast.
It's not. We're explicit.
Oh, great. Yeah, I was all ready to gather the kids around the radio to listen to this, but I guess I'm going to have to shut it around the... Two hour mark? They'll probably be asleep by then.
When you get to Uncle Matt's closing remarks, just hit that mute button, okay?
Interesting world, though.
Matt, Fred, thank you so much for coming on and grading this reign of Garpax with me. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having us, Matt.
It was an honor as the official voice of the fan, and Matt is the other voice of the fan. We're both grateful for this time. Man, it's always good to talk to you, Mr. Puck. You're always enjoyable to talk to. This is one of my favorite conversations I've ever had with you. I really enjoyed it. You know what was surprising? I don't know if you feel this way too, Matt. I think this was we were in agreement for probably about good 70-80% of the podcast. Maybe not that much.
I think we agreed on a lot of things, except you know when host Matt revealed the final tallies of the grades that we gave this particular set of individuals. I think other than that, you're right. We saw a lot of things similarly. We just interpret them in very different ways.
I must admit, even I was a little embarrassed with the 15, considering the results of the last few years. That's probably not an accurate assessment.
Well, again, guys, thank you so much again for coming on.
Good stuff. Can we go back?
Thank you for listening to the Rebuildable Podcast. Be sure to check out more episodes on Google Play, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and on Rebuildable.com.